Hello and welcome back to the Nowhere Office, wherever you are, with me, Julia Hobsbawm.
And me, Stefan Stern.
This is the podcast which looks at the world of work as it is, as it could be, should be, might be, with some of the leading thinkers and doers of the day. Well, we're delighted in this second episode of the new series in which we look and think very closely about America and the state of work in America to be joined by one of truly the foremost voices of expertise in that subject. She is Juliet Shaw. She is an economist and sociology professor at Boston College. She's been studying trends in working time, work and family, the gig economy, as well as matters like climate and work, and very notably, most recently, the four-day week for many years. Well, seminal first book that burst onto the scene of this area was published in 1992, The Overworked American. Juliet, we're delighted to have you with us. Hi.
Hi, wonderful to be here.
And you're up bright and early. So Stefan and I are sort of going to play tag, asking you questions. We're bursting with things to ask you about. I guess what I'd like to know first of all is, you know, what are you working on at the moment? What do you make of this moment of work in America? What's catching your eye?
So most of my time is devoted to studying interventions in companies and nonprofits where employers are giving a four-day, 32-hour week with no reduction in pay. And this is something that I started studying in February of 2022. We have been running trials or pilots, as they're called, six-month tests of this intervention. We look at what happens. We've been doing it around the world, collaborating with an organization called 4-Day Week Global. And we now have hundreds of organizations, thousands of employees who have gone through these trials, and we've had phenomenal results.
Although some of these results are effectively organic, aren't they? We're recording on a day when the Financial Times has run a piece by a US labor correspondent saying Fridays are dead in corporate America, that de facto the four-day week is becoming institutionalized without the legislation. What do you say to that?
There's definitely been that trend, much more pronounced in the summers. I mean, and that started even pre-pandemic, where you had companies going to shorter hours on Fridays in the summers, or some giving Fridays off altogether. You've also had an organic movement toward no meeting Fridays, in which that sort of allows people to take the day off, even if it's not officially sanctioned. So yes, there has been that. It's sort of interesting to me that this piece comes at the end of the summer. So, you know, it's journalism, right? So how much that's really a summer phenomenon versus a year-round phenomenon, I think, is a question. The New York Times ran a piece like this on what was going on in Lower Manhattan, I think, 2 years ago. So one of the things I typically say about this and the four-day week is that it is evolving, and the way it's evolving is these changing Friday patterns. So I think there is a lot of truth to that perspective.
If we're heading, Juliet, to what we might now characterize as the properly worked American or the appropriately worked American, why has it taken businesses so long since your book came out 30 years ago when you warned and flagged up the overworked American as a concept? Why has it taken so long to get to something more rational and reasonable?
Yeah, that's a great question. A lot of that book was devoted to why working hours are so high. And it focused really on the sort of structural features of the U.S. economy that that led it to diverge from Europe after the Second World War. So there are a couple of things. One is very important, the way health insurance is financed in the United States. Through an accident that happened during the Second World War, in which wage controls led employers to add non-monetary benefits to attract workers, in this case, health insurance. That accident was never corrected, and it was a real tragedy because it led to this major sort of dysfunctionality in the U.S. labor market, which is and especially because the U.S. healthcare system became so dysfunctional and expensive, it created a huge tax on every employee, which led companies to want fewer employees working longer hours. That's number one. And we also have a lot of other per-person taxes and costs to employers that further that sort of incentive structure of small headcount, long hours. Second thing is the weakness of unions and the conservatism of American unions. The U.S. was at the forefront of work time reduction before the Second World War. After the Second World War, we had the Cold War, which weakened the unions who were most interested in work time reduction, the more left-wing unions, and then eventually the weakening of unions themselves. And unions had been at the forefront also of work time reduction. So those are two really major factors. The third is that we moved towards salaried workers in a big way. And when workers are paid by salary, there is an incentive for employers to work them longer hours because they're unpaid hours. And I developed a little model years ago that showed for the same workers, merely shifting from hourly to salary would add about a range, depending on model assumptions, of at least about 150 hours per year. So that's a big difference. One last point on this, which I think is really important. Many people think that the sort of culture of overwork and long hours in the U.S. are a sort of deep cultural trait of America. And I really want to push back against that idea because, as I just said, we were at the forefront of work time reduction for so long. We got the 5-day week and the 8-hour day and so forth long before Europe. And so it's nothing deep in our tradition. It's not from the Puritans. It's not, the Protestant work ethic. I just think it really has to do with the political and economic forces that transformed that our labor markets in the post-World War II period.
I know Stefan will want to come back in on the labor markets, and there's a huge upswell of trade union, or at least visible upswell of trade union activity in America. Could you unpack a bit for us, Juliet? Are we distinguishing leisure from less work because nobody wants to be overworked? Or are you also advocating and pro-leisure for its own sake, rest?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And I think it goes to sort of thinking about what's happening in the current moment. And I think there are two things. So for sure, people are sort of really craving time for themselves, leisure time, and more balance in their work lives. And a big part of it has to do with the fact that their experience of the weekend now is that it's too short. Why? Because we have so many dual-earner families or single-headed families, and people have to spend a lot of time on the weekend doing unpaid work. And so the amount of time that they have to just relax, recuperate, do things that they care about other than work is too short. And so that's a part of it. And part of how we're seeing that is in our studies of what people are doing on their off day in the 4-day week studies is the number one thing is they're devoting it to kind of hobbies and leisure activities. So absolutely strong craving for that. But there's another part of this, which is that the stress of work is creating just a really strong demand for recuperation. So that's different than that sort of affirmative desire for leisure. If you think about, what sociologists and philosophers and others have written about and the need for people to have that free time to do, the sorts of things that we can do that edify us and so forth. It's just also like needing that downtime to get yourself back to the office on Monday, because for a lot of people, that's becoming very difficult.
And you touched on unpaid work. So let me, as a man, ask, is there a sex problem here? I mean, in terms of domestic work and unpaid work, are women still bearing far more of that burden than men? Is that a problem here?
Well, yes, they are still bearing more of it. Far more than it was. So there's some equalization going on. One of the interesting findings, we think, of our research is that the imbalance in heterosexual couples in housework and childcare gets a little bit less unbalanced in the four-day-week condition. So we ask people about their share of housework and childcare. And what we find is men do more when they have a four-day week than previously. More on the childcare. And that's also been a long-standing finding, that men are taking up more childcare, more enjoyable than, you know, the drudgery of housework.
There's also been some really interesting research by Claudia Goldin on this, hasn't there, in terms of the childcare impact on white-collar work. And, you know, she produced some fascinating data on that. But can we come back to the politics of the four-day week? Because I don't know whether, well, I do know, I'm personally not convinced about the need for rigidity in an increasingly flexible world. How convince me that we need a four-day week as outlined by your campaign, which is certainly getting a lot of attention and is certainly getting piloted, do you think will be a worldwide norm in the foreseeable future? And if not, why not? So I'm your global critic. Why am I wrong to resist a rigid model of the four-day week?
All right. So let's start with that word flexibility. And I think that to say the four-day week is rigid and something else is flexible is the wrong way to think about it from the beginning. So first point has to do with that sort of whole agenda of flexibility, which has been at the core of dealing with work, life, problems, stress, overload, etc., for decades now. I mean, even thinking about post-overworked American, although yes, there was a lot of attention to the issue back in the 90s when I wrote that book. The way it evolved in American workplaces, and I'll start, you know, let me talk about America because that's the place I know this best, and then we can go global, is an individual flexibility norm. And so what happened was that companies began to give people the opportunity to change their schedule and so forth. And that whole agenda, I would say, has been a failure. And I think the reason it's been a failure is that it focused on the individual and it did not address the so-called ideal worker norm or the individuals who took up flexibility in the workplace, particularly if it meant working shorter hours, were stigmatized, penalized, and sort of, you know, like pointed out in ways that were very detrimental to their careers. So if you wanted a short hour job, you paid a big, big price. Number one, you had to take a pay cut for it. And number two, your career just typically would, you know, flatten out. So that agenda didn't work. Or take something like work from home, which turned out to be extremely popular, we know, when the pandemic happened. You know, we could have done that telework, it used to be called. We could have had large numbers of people doing that at great benefit to themselves pre-pandemic, but almost no one was a teleworker. Again, because of the penalties of doing it and the difficulties of the individualization. So that's one thing. The thing about the four-day week is it happens at the organizational level. So no one is penalized for those short hours. Everyone's treated the same. And that's really important. It preserves fairness in the workplace. It helps with those gender and racial discriminatory dynamics and so forth. And the other thing is that it allows the productivity benefits of shorter work time to be realized, because when it's just an individual doing it, you don't get those. So what these four-day week organizations are doing is they are sort of reconfiguring their work cultures and their processes in ways that allow them to do about as much, let's just say broad strokes, we can get into that, but about as much in 20% less time. Now, that may sound magical. Economists will say, how could you possibly do that? We can talk more about that. But this is what they're telling us they are able to do, and we're seeing it happen. So that's the first point, which is that you need that organization-wide and rather than individual flexibility. That being said, the way these companies are doing it is flexible. So they do it in different ways. Some of them let people choose their day off. Nobody is forcing people to work less. And we are finding people in these companies who don't work less. They use Fridays as a buffer day, for example, which allows them to, you know, save their night times and weekends a little bit. Or the people who just like to work more, work more. It creates an organizational norm. It disrupts the ideal worker norm. The ideal worker norm meaning you're available 24/7 whenever your boss needs you, whenever the organization calls on you, et cetera, which is just, you know, it's killing people.
Stefan, over to you. And where are you on this? Because Stefan and I often politely disagree. Come on, nail your colors to the mast, Mr.
Well, I'm very interested in how these pilots are playing out, because, I mean, I recognize your concern about doing it in a thoughtless way could build a new, just a different sort of rigidity. But if you're thinking about the collective performance, I was wondering, Juliet, are some of the pilots working better where there is more effective employee or formal or otherwise employee representation? Because obviously unions have always been interested in the organization of work. It's not just asking for more pay or more benefits. More progressive or thoughtful unions, as you were hinting, have often wanted to make a contribution in terms of a better performance of the business, because it's in their interest too. So what role is employee representation playing in making the four-day week land better?
Yeah, we don't know the answer to that question yet, because in these first stage of the pilots, not enough of these workplaces are unionized. That is really starting to change rapidly now. And we are starting to see more and more unionized workplaces putting in demands for the four-day week. The UAW being the most prominent at the moment in the US, and IG Metall in Germany. My contacts there are telling me they're putting 32-hour week into their negotiations this fall for steel, 90,000 workers. So we will have a good answer to your question soon. But I think the other part, sort of if you think about employee representation more broadly and not just formal unionization, a key part of the model that companies in our trials are following is to empower people all the way down to the bottom level to figure out how to do that work reorganization. So there, typically what's happening here is senior management, often the CEO, president, founder, a lot of these are small companies, says, we're going to do this, but we really sort of push them a lot to say, let the people who are doing the work figure out how to make it work. So it's not that the people at the top are telling you how to do 5 days work in four, which, you know, it sounds like that sounds like a problematic dynamic, but get together with your team and figure out how you can save time and do things more efficiently. So there's an empowerment aspect to it, but not, we don't have enough to look at unions specifically.
Let's talk a bit more about the unions, because the perception is that there is a lot more organized labor and visible pushback. But numerically, I think I'm right that the number of Americans joining trade unions has not risen. And yet there are highly visible strikes with Amazon, with Starbucks. Obviously, the Hollywood strike of writers is reaching a critical point 4 months in, where it's on the brink now of getting very, very dangerous. What is your take on the trade unions and their role in work? You know, let's not even call it labor. That almost sounds kind of, you know, fairly old school. It's about work, isn't it? And working life. What's going on there, Juliet?
Yeah, I think there's no doubt there's an upsurge in interest in unions, in certainly the survey data on favorability of unions hasn't been higher in, you know, decades and decades. The numbers won't show it at the moment because those you've got those two cases you talked about, Starbucks and Amazon, very large companies, but so far they have been able to hold off the pressures for unionization in, you know, in large part by doing things that are, you know, turning out to be understood as illegal by our National Labor Relations Board. And so whether they will be able to withstand that pressure, I think it's, you know, it's a growing pressure, particularly Starbucks. Amazon, I think, is, you know, a little bit behind in terms of how much of their labor force is really on board with unionization. But I'll refer to work that I did very beginning of my career when I was still a graduate student. I developed a measure called the cost of job loss. And it was just a numerical measure of a concept that was then in vogue in labor economics, which is the so-called employment rent, or we called it efficiency wages, which is the idea that companies were paying higher than a market wage in order to create more scarcity value to workers for their jobs. And that meant they would work harder and longer and be more pliable and so forth. And that the size of that difference between what a worker earned on the job and what they could get if they were fired and they're sort of looking at their next best alternative, that difference, as it ebbed and flowed, you know, got bigger and smaller, turned out to affect a lot of things. Now, I found an amazing data set from the UK, actually, because of its stronger history of Taylorism than in the US, which was literally an intensity of work. So literally, how hard were people working? And I showed that when the cost of job loss went up, they worked harder. And similarly, when it went down, they worked less. And for the US, this measure predicted strikes better than any other measure that was out there. And that it was a crude measure. I went to graduate school a long time ago. Today we would have had, you know, we'd have much more sophisticated ways of measuring this. But the key variable was the duration of unemployment. Mostly economists had thought about the unemployment rate, but it turned out the duration of unemployment predicts so many things. It's like an Uber variable. And I sometimes think if I stuck on that, I would, you know, be such a famous economist now. But, you know, I published just one paper on it, but the duration of unemployment is so low right now. So yes, of course, you're going to get lots and lots of strike activity. And the question is, how long is that going to continue? And I think that gets us back to the question of politics, because something very different, I think, is happening in the US labor market today than pre-pandemic, which is that political forces, for sure Democrats, but I think also Republicans to a certain extent, are unwilling to end the party, as it were. They are unwilling to inflict pain, the level of pain on the American worker that they would have been pre-pandemic and pre-Bernie Sanders. And so if you think about what Larry Summers and him, you know, going all around the country and talking about how much the Fed needs to cause a recession and cause unemployment to get inflation down and break the back of the workers and so forth. In any other era, whoever was in power would have been listening to him. And today, nobody's doing that. The Fed is acting very cautiously. The Biden administration absolutely does not want to break the American worker, does not want to cause unemployment and sort of create, take away that labor market pressure. And it's not just about inflation. It's also just about the power of workers in the labor market. And so we have a very different situation, which is going to continue. I'm not saying forever, but I don't think there's any appetite among elites to dramatically change what's going on in the labor market. And so I think we are going to see that for some time now, and it's going to affect unionization. And it's a big reason why I think the four-day week is going to continue to have momentum, because of the sort of finally, after decades of the power all being on the side of the employers, things have changed.
Stefan, you're witness.
Yeah.
That was a great long explanation, and I feel 10 feet taller intellectually as a result, Julia. Thank you. Stefan.
Yeah, am I going on too long on these?
No, not remotely. Okay, it's great. Fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating.
I was about to ask, until you turned the corner and came back to the four-day working week, I was about to ask, so you answered it already, is this a sort of fertile ground for a more rational discussion, a more rational approach to jobs, output, productivity? I love this. It's a new one on me, I'm afraid, but you could tell me more about it. This the norm of the idealized worker, which lingers in the minds of maybe too many managers, that there's a sort of perfectly shaped, perfectly productive, perfectly efficient worker who just delivers like a robot. I mean, that's the other part of the discussion we haven't had yet. I mean, the attraction, of course, of AI and automation robots is, you know, they don't ask for more money. They don't ask for breaks. They'll do the hours that you keep them doing if the on switch is still on. So tell me a little bit more about how the notion of the worker is developing in the eyes and in the minds of thoughtful managers and thoughtful organizations.
Yeah. Well, I think the ideal worker norm came about in an era of male breadwinning and female homemaking. So it's somebody who doesn't have any other obligations and is therefore available to the organization pretty much whenever they need them. And, you know, in the 1950s, when that was a more common model in the United States, It wasn't so onerous for the men who had to conform to it, because working hours weren't as long and the demands weren't as high, and you didn't have the access in the home to workers through all the technology that you now do. And so people worked while they were in the office, so they went home, and, you know, they might get a call from their boss occasionally, but home time was protected in a way that, of course, we all know that sort of goes away eventually. And so people, you know, become subject to that. And women, of course, also have to conform to the ideal worker norm. And that's a key part of why in the United States, for example, the pressures on women are so great. Employed women are so great, particularly in comparison to European women, for whom there is less, I think, of those that sort of ideal worker demands, particularly at some of the higher levels. There's a Caitlin Collins did an interesting comparison of Germany, Italy, and the U.S. called Making Motherhood Work. And it's about the sort of, I mean, there are demands on mothers in all of these countries. And so combining work and family is difficult. But the U.S. was sort of the worst case in terms of the demands, absolutely unmanageable situation, particularly for higher educated women. I mean, in terms of demands from the workplace, and then for lower educated women, the impossibilities of doing it on the low pay that people are getting. So in the U.S., the women are getting it on both ends, because they're not making enough at one end and the demands are just overwhelming at the other.
You could argue, though, that women have not campaigned materially on this since the pandemic, that the last women's movement in the workplace has been around Me Too and has been very, very valid. But, you know, the reality is, when we're now seeing these huge, significant inequalities between the American working norm and the rest of the world, and maternity rights and maternity leave is a very material one, You know, where are the women's campaigns saying this is the moment to reform? I mean, I've covered it a little bit myself in my column in Bloomberg. There has been the first change in 40 years to the Pregnancy Act, so that it is there are some protections. But does that surprise you, Juliet, that women have not gathered and taken, as you've identified, there's a sort of gap, there's a space that the trade unions are capitalizing on, that the four-day week is capitalizing on. Where are the women in this?
I think they're just in the labor movement. They are with the men as opposed to, you know, a more specialized movement. Because
and is that okay? I mean, is that, it's not even okay. Is that sort of, does that interest you sociologically, or you think it might have been different? What, I'm slightly surprised. I mean, in the UK, there's a campaign called Pregnant Then Screwed, which has done extremely well. And has been, I don't really see the equivalent of that in the US, unless I'm mistaken.
Yeah, fair point. There's been a little bit of movement around the cost of menstrual products, which is a women's issue, if we want to think of it that way. Of course, women are busy defending our rights, our reproductive rights, and that's, you know, not a specifically workplace issue, although it has workplace dimensions. I think that's where we're focused, because that is such a dire and urgent, not just threat, but reality to women's well-being right now. And so that may account for part of it. It's also interesting to me, the women's work agenda, if we want to just call it that, is very well represented and integrated into the Biden administration. So we have the child care credit, and many of the people who have worked on these women and work issues for years are in that administration. And so I think they're also sort of quietly working away on things, but not necessarily, you know, because of a groundswell of sort of social movement activity, which, as I say, is pretty oriented to abortion right now, or reproductive rights and health.
I think that's a fair point. Stefan is going to ask the last question, which we ask of all our guests, which is about you and how you work and how you don't work. But I just wanted to ask cultural point, really, going back to your point about Taylorism being less widely adopted in the US rather than where it originated, and in fact more widely adopted, these rigid management techniques in Europe. And it's a sort of contradiction about America which grips me. But on the one hand, you know, it's the reddest in tooth and claw capitalist. It, you know, automation, the production line, the work ethic we've been describing. And yet, as you alluded to, it was Henry Ford who brought in Taylor, who introduced, through pressure from the trade unions and through genuine feedback, the five-day week. So there's a sort of yin-yang thing with America, isn't it? It's kind of hard-nosed, terrible to its workers one minute, and really quite enlightened the next.
Yes, and I do think that is part of that larger situation here, which is, you know, I'll take it back to the concept of the cost of job loss, but in a sort of much larger, thinking about it in a much larger way, which is that we had the frontier, which was the safety valve, and created more power for workers in the U.S. because they had that ability to exit. And so it's also part of the high earlier, not only shorter work time, but higher wages here, higher productivity historically. And I think that sort of looser kind of society in a certain way than in Europe, where, you know, high levels of self-employment and so forth, even if we were, you know, eventually sort of our workers are weaker on the trade union side, there is this other part of America, that more mobile, fluid, you know, as things really deteriorate here, of course, that gets so much weaker, and that they do deteriorate here in a big way. And you know, U.S. workers end up so much weaker than European workers who built those trade unions, which held. And in the U.S., the trade unions we built didn't hold. And, you know, now we're faced with having to rebuild them. But yes, and I think that is part of what gives that dual-sided kind of fascinating dimension to the U.S.
Well, Juliet, thanks so much. You've proven your work ethic this morning by starting your day even before 8 a.m. your time. We're very grateful to you. But in those moments when you're not actually hard at it, what are your preferred non-work leisure options, and how do you balance your other interests with your academic career and research and so on?
Yeah, well, at this point, I have a lot of freedom in what I do with my time. Also, my children are adults now, so I'm not sort of having to do that other work. I'm doing a few things. I mean, I sort of obviously read. I've gotten a little bit into watching British television.
Obviously.
No, not that one. That's funny. No, I like your police and thriller shows, and you have an endless number of police shows. I'm just a passionate Le Carré fan. But I've also gotten into word games, and you know that's a pandemic thing, crosswords and acrostics and that sort of thing. I just find that, and then so now we're confessing all. Another thing that I have found interesting, and this is another pandemic habit I've picked up, but maybe because of its ability to shed light on the culture, which is that I've started reading advice columns, which I U.S. advice columns, which I find really interesting. So that must be common because they are proliferating like mushrooms after a rain. I mean, they're just everywhere.
That's fascinating. We've actually had Carla L. Miller, the workplace advice columnist of the Washington Post, on, who's fantastic. And I think her column was supposed to last a week and has lasted years. Juliet Shaw, thank you so much. It's been a really rich and enlightening, and helps us set the scene for our audience around the world, in the UK, where we're based, and in the US, where we're spending a lot of time. Thank you so much for being with us on the Nowhere Office. This has been a Fully Connected production with me, Julia Hobsbawm.
And me, Stefan Stern.
And our editor is Kevin Hershen, who's editing from Miami. Thank you for listening. You know where to find us. Thank you for watching if you're watching on LinkedIn. We'll talk to you next time. Thank you.